Chapter 45. A flood of information on what became known as the Flamborough Crisis poured through teletype and computer into the Pentagon's Military Command Center, the State Department's 7th Floor Operations Center, and the War Games Room in the old Executive Office Building. From each of these strategy tanks, the data were assembled and analyzed with almost lightning speed. Then the condensed version, fused with recommendations, was rushed to the Situation Room located in the White House basement for final assessment. The President, dressed casually in slacks and a woolen turtleneck, entered the room and sat at one end of the long conference table. After being updated on the situation, he would ask for options from his advisors for appropriate action. Though final decisions were his alone, he was heavily reinforced by crisis management veterans who labored in search of a policy consensus and stood ready to carry it out once he gave it his stamp of approval, despite dissenting opinions. The intelligence reports from Egypt were mostly all bad. A state of anarchy was in full swing. The situation was deteriorating by the hour. The police and military forces remained in their barracks, while thousands of Ahmad Yazid's followers staged strikes and boycotts throughout the country. The only shred of good news was that the demonstrations were not marked by violence. Secretary of State Douglas Oates briefly examined a report that was placed in front of him by an aide. "That's all we need," he muttered. The President looked at him expectantly in silence. "The Muslim rebels have just stormed and taken Cairo's major TV station. Any appearance by Yazid?" "Still a no-show." CIA Chief Brogan walked over from one of the computer monitors. "The latest intelligence says he's still holed up in his villa outside Alexandria, waiting to form a new government by acclamation." "Shouldn't be long now," the President sighed wearily. "What stance are the Israeli ministers taking?" Oates neatly stacked some papers as he spoke. "Strictly a wait-and-see attitude. They don't picture Yazid as an immediate threat. They'll change their tune when he tears up the Camp David peace accord." The President turned and coldly stared into Brogan's eyes. "Can we take him out?" "Yes." Brogan's answer was flat, emphatic. "How?" "In the event it comes back to haunt your administration, Mr. President, I respectfully suggest you don't know." The President bowed his head slightly in agreement. "You're probably right. Still, you can't do the job unless I give the order." "I strongly urge you not to resort to assassination," said Oates. "Doug Oates is right," said Julia Schiller. "It could boomerang. If word leaked out, you'd be considered fair game by Middle East terrorist leaders." "Not to mention the uproar from Congress," added Dale Nichols, who sat midway down the table, "and the press would murder you." The President thoughtfully weighed the consequences. Then he finally nodded. "All right, so long as Yazid hates Soviet Premier Antonov as much as he does me, we'll put his demise on the back burner for now. But bear this in mind, gentlemen, I'm not about to take half the crap from this nut that Khomeini dished out to my predecessors." Brogan scowled, but an expression of relief was exchanged between Oates and Schiller. Nichols merely puffed contentedly on his pipe. The actors in the drama were strong men with definite and often conflicting viewpoints. Victory came easy, but defeat smoldered. The President shifted the agenda. "Any late word on Mexico?" "The situation is uncomfortably quiet," answered Brogan. "No demonstrations, no rioting. Topiltzin appears to be playing the same waiting game as his brother." The President looked up, puzzled. "Did I hear you correctly? You said brother?" Brogan tilted his head toward Nichols. "Dale made a good call. Yazid and Topiltzin are brothers, who are neither Egyptian nor Mexican by birth." "You've definitely proven a family connection," Schiller interrupted in astonishment. "You have proof?" "Our operatives obtained and matched their genetic codes." "This is the first I've heard about it," said a stunned President. "You should have informed me sooner." "The final documentation is still being evaluated and will be sent over from Langley shortly." "I'm sorry, Mr. President. At the risk of sounding overly cautious, I didn't want to throw out such a shocking discovery until we had gathered solid evidence." "How in hell did you get their genetic codes?" asked Nichols. Both those guys are vain promoters, explained Brogan. Our forgery department sent a Koran to Yazid and a photograph to Topiltzin, showing him in full Aztec regalia, along with requests begging them in each to inscribe a short prayer on both items and return them. Actually, it was a bit more complicated, writing the requests in the handwriting of known adoring followers. Influential followers with financial and political clout, I might add. Both fell for it. The tricky part was intercepting the return mail before it reached the correct addresses. The next problem was sifting out the several sets of fingerprints which accompanied each object. Aides, secretaries, whoever. One thumbprint on the Koran matched with a known set of Yazid's prints that were on file with Egyptian police when he was arrested several years ago. We then traced his DNA from his fingerprint oils. Topiltzin was not so easy. He had no record in Mexico, but the lab matched his code to his brother's from prints pulled from the photo. Then a chance find in the international criminal records at Interpol's Paris headquarters dealt us a straight flush. It all came together. What we'd stumbled on was a family organization, a crime dynasty that arose after World War II. A billion-dollar empire ruled by a mother and father, three brothers and a sister, who spearhead the operations and run by a network of uncles, aunts, cousins, or whoever is related by blood or marriage. This tight association has made it nearly impossible for international investigators to penetrate. Except for the click of the teletype machines and the hushed murmur of aides, a stunned silence settled over the table. Brogan looked from Nichols to Schiller to Oates to the president. "Their name?" the president asked softly. "Capesterre," answered Brogan. "Roland and Josephine Capesterre are the father and mother. Their eldest son is Robert, or, as we know him, Topiltzin. The next brother in line is Paul."
"He's Yazid?"
"Yes." "I think we'd be interested in hearing all you know," said the president. "As I've stated," said Brogan, "I don't have all the facts at my fingertips, such as the whereabouts of Carl and Marie, the younger brother and sister, or the names of associate relatives. We've only scratched the surface. From what I recall, the Capesterres are a tradition-bound criminal family that began almost 80 years ago when the grandfather emigrated from France to the Caribbean and launched a smuggling business, moving stolen goods and bootleg booze to the U.S. during Prohibition. At first he operated out of Port of Spain, Trinidad, but as he prospered, he bought a small nearby island and set up business there. Roland took over when the old man died, and along with his wife, Josephine, some claim she's the brain behind the throne, lost no time in expanding into drug traffic. First they built their island into a legitimate banana plantation, making a nice, honest profit. Next, they turned inventive and made a real killing by harvesting two crops. The second, marijuana, was cultivated under the banana trees to avoid detection. They also set up a refining lab on the island. Have I painted a clear picture?"
"Yes," the president said slowly. "We all see it clearly. Thank you, Martin."
"They had it all worked out," murmured Schiller. "The Capesterres produced, manufactured, and smuggled in one efficient operation." "And distributed," Brogan continued. "But interestingly, not in the U.S. They sold the drugs only in Europe and the Far East." "Are they still into narcotics?" asked Nichols.
"No." Brogan shook his head.
"Through contacts, they received a tip their private island was about to be raided by the joint West Indies security forces. The family burned the marijuana crop, kept the banana plantation, and began buying controlling interests in financially shaky corporations. They became extremely successful in turning businesses around and showing staggering profits. Of course, their unusual method of management might have had something to do with it." Nichols took the hook. "What was their system?" Brogan grinned. "The Capesterres relied on blackmail, extortion, and murder. Any time a competing company got in the way, the corporate executive officers, for some strange reason, initiated merger negotiations with the Capesterre interests, losing their collective asses on the deal, naturally. Developers who hindered projects, opposing lawyers with lawsuits, unfriendly politicians, they all came to know and love the Capesterres. Or one sunny day their wives and kids had accidents.
Their houses burned to the ground, or they just up and vanished. Kind of like the Mafia managing General Motors or Gulf and Western, said the President, sardonically. A fair comparison. Brogan nodded politely and continued. Now the family controls a vast, worldwide conglomeration of financial and industrial enterprises worth an estimated $12 billion. Billion is spelled with a B, Oates mumbled incredulously. I may never attend church services again. Schiller shrugged wonderingly. Who said crime doesn't pay? No wonder they're pulling the strings in Egypt and Mexico, said Oates. They must have bought, blackmailed, or strong-armed their way into every department of the government and military. I begin to see how their scheme is coming together, said the President. But what I can't understand is how can the sons pass themselves off as native-born Egyptians or Mexicans? No one can fool millions of people without somebody getting wise. Their mother was descended from black slaves, which accounts for their dark skin, Brogan said in a patiently explaining tone. We can only speculate about their past. Roland and Josephine must have laid the groundwork 40 or more years ago. As their children were born, they began a vigorous program of making over the boys into foreign nationals. Paul was no doubt tutored in Arabic before he could walk, while Robert learned to speak in ancient Aztec. When the boys became older, they probably attended private schools in both Mexico and Egypt under assumed names. A grand plan, muttered Oates admiringly. Nothing so mundane as burying intelligence moles, but infiltration at the very highest levels, and with the image of a messiah thrown in for good measure. Sounds pretty diabolical to me, said Nichols. I agree with Doug, said the President, nodding at Oates. A grand plan. Training children from birth, using untold wealth and power to set up a national takeover. What we're really looking at here is an incredible display of unbending doggedness and patience. You have to give the bastards credit, Schiller admitted. They stuck to their script until events swung in their favor. Now they're within centimeters of ruling two of the Third World's leading countries. We can't allow it to happen, the President said bluntly. If the brother in Mexico becomes head of state and makes good his threat by driving 2 million of his countrymen across our borders, I see no choice but to send in our armed forces. I must caution against aggressive action, said Oates, speaking like a Secretary of State. Recent history has shown that invaders do not fare well. Assassinating Yazid and Topiltzin, or whatever their names, and launching an assault on Mexico won't solve the long-range problem. Maybe not, grunted the President, but it will damn well give us time to ease the situation. There may be another solution, said Nichols. Use the Capesterres against themselves. I'm tired, said the President, stress showing in the lines around his eyes. Please skip the riddles. Nichols looked at Brogan for support. These men were drug traffickers. They must be wanted criminals, is that right? Yes, on the first, no on the second, answered Brogan. They're no petty street crooks. The entire family has been under investigation for years. No arrests, no convictions. They've got a staff of corporate and criminal lawyers that would put Washington's biggest law office to shame. They've got friends and connections that go straight to the top of 10 major governments. You want to pick up this bunch and put them on trial? You'd do better tearing down the pyramids with an ice pick. Then expose them to the world for the scum they are, pursued Nichols. No good, said the President. Any attempt will surely backlash as a lie and propaganda ploy. Nichols might have a direction, said Schiller quietly. He was a man who listened more than he spoke. All we need is a base that can't be cracked or shattered. The President looked speculatively at Schiller. Where are you leading, Julius? The Lady Flamborough, replied Schiller, his face carefully pensive. Come up with indisputable proof that Yazid is behind the ship's hijacking, and we can crack the Capesterre wall. Brogan nodded heavily. The ensuing scandal would certainly be a step in stripping away Yazid's and Topiltzin's mystiques and opening the door to the family's countless criminal activities. Don't forget the world news media. They'd have a shark-feeding frenzy once they bit into the Capesterre's bloody past. Nichols belatedly winced at his unthinking pun. You're all overlooking one important fact, Schiller said with a long sigh. At the moment, any tie between the ship's disappearance and the Capesterres is strictly circumstantial. Nichols frowned. Who else has motives for getting rid of Presidents De Lorenzo and Hassan and Halakamil? No one, Brogan said heatedly. Wait up, the President said patiently. Julius has a sound point. The hijackers are not acting like typical Middle East terrorists. They have yet to identify themselves. They've made no demands or threats. Nor have they used the crew and passengers as hostages for international blackmail. I'm not ashamed to admit I find the silence nightmarish. We're faced with a different breed this time, admitted Brogan. The Capesterres are playing a waiting game, hoping De Lorenzo's and Hassan's governments will fall in their absence. Any word on the cruise ship since George Pitt's son discovered the switch? Asked Oates, coolly steering the discussion clear of an impending confrontation. Somewhere off the east coast of Tierra del Fuego, replied Schiller. Sailing like hell to the south. We are tracking by satellite and should have her cornered by this time tomorrow. The President didn't look happy. The hijackers could have murdered everyone on board by then. If they haven't already, said Brogan. What forces do we have in the area?
Virtually none, Mr. President, answered Nichols. We have no call to maintain a presence that far south. Except for a few Air Force transport planes ferrying supplies to polar research stations, the only U.S. vessel anywhere near the Lady Flamborough is the Sounder, a NUMA deepwater survey ship.
The one carrying Dirk Pitt?
Yes, sir.
What about our special forces people?
I was on the phone with General Keith at the Pentagon 20 minutes ago, Schiller volunteered. An elite team, along with their equipment, boarded C-140 cargo jets and took off about an hour ago. They were accompanied by a wing of Osprey assault aircraft. The President sat back in the chair and folded his hands.
Where will they set up their command post?
Brogan called up a map displaying the tip of South America on a giant wall monitor. He used a flashlight arrow to indicate a particular spot. Unless we receive new information that will alter the tentative plan, he explained, they'll land at an airport outside the small Chilean city of Punta Arenas on the Brunswick Peninsula and use it as a base for operations.
A long flight, said the President quietly. When will they arrive?
Inside 15 hours. The President looked at Oates.
Doug, I leave it to you to handle any sovereignty issues with the Chilean and Argentine governments.
I'll see to it.
The Lady Flamborough will have to be found before the Special Forces can launch a rescue attempt, said Schiller with remorseless logic.
We're up the creek on this one. There was a curious acceptance in Brogan's voice. The closest carrier fleet is almost 5,000 miles away. No way a full-scale air and sea search can be mounted.
Schiller stared at the table thoughtfully. Any rescue attempt could take weeks if the hijackers slip the Lady Flamborough in among the barren bays and coves along the Antarctic coastline. Fog, mist, and low overcast wouldn't help matters either.
Satellite surveillance is our only tool, said Nichols. The predicament is that we have no spy satellites eyeballing that region of the Earth.
Dale is right, Schiller agreed. The far southern seas are not high on the strategic surveillance list. If we were talking northern hemisphere, we could focus a whole array of listening and imagery gear to tune in conversations on board the ship and read a newspaper on deck.
What's available? The President asked.
The Landsat, answered Brogan. A few defense meteorological satellites and a CSAT used by NUMA for Antarctic ice and sea current surveys. But our best bet is the SR-90 Casper.
Do we have SR-90 reconnaissance aircraft in Latin America?
A tight security airfield in Texas is as close as we come.
How long to fly one down and back?
A Casper is capable of reaching Mach 5 or just under 5,000 kilometers per hour. One can fly to the tip of Antarctica, make a photo run, and have the film back in 5 hours.
The President slowly shook his head in dismay. Will someone please tell me why the United States government is always caught with our pants down? I swear to God, nobody screws up like we do. We build the most sophisticated detection systems the world has ever known, and when we need them, they're all concentrated in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Nobody spoke. Nobody moved.
The President's men avoided his eyes and stared uncomfortably at the table, papers, wall, anything but another face.
At last, Nichols spoke in a quiet, confident voice.
We'll find the ship, Mr. President. If anyone can get them out alive, the Special Forces will.
Yes, the President drawled softly. They're highly trained for such a mission. The only question in my mind is whether the crew and passengers will be there to be rescued.
Or will the Special Forces find a silent ship filled with corpses?